Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know when you tear lettuce and the edges turn brown? Well, that happens because the leaves are trying to heal the break by sending antioxidants to the edges. So it's possible that torn lettuce is better for us. Well, this is from a new nutrition book with a different take on what to eat. Its author, Joe Robinson's done 10 years immersed in the new science of phytonutrients.
Unwittingly, starting 10,000 years ago, we started choosing plants to grow that were higher in sugar, higher in starch, and lower in phytonutrients. And that trend, it continues today.
The book is Eating on the Wild Side. And one premise is 5 helpings a day of any produce is not going to do the health trick, but 5 helpings a day of the right produce will. Stay with us for the reasons why and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today's show is about opportunities. For instance, the chance to do an unforgettable summer party laid out for you by the genius of quirky entertaining. The fruit detective talks the latest opportunity for grapes. Their identity crisis could be over. Your front lawn? Well, that's one big opportunity just waiting to become green art. We have the artist who's making that happen around the world. And that opportunity for 5 a day at the farmer's market? Well, it's trickier than you think because you have to know your phytonutrients. But first, I'm going to take an opportunity to talk to you. We've got Amy on the line calling from Detroit, and she's got a great question. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Lynn. I have a sort of universal question about recipes and recipe writers.
Yeah.
When I was making something recently, I had a recipe that called for 2 pounds of dates, pitted. And I didn't know if that was the same as 2 pounds of pitted dates. And the same question comes up often with nuts, whether 1 cup of chopped nuts is the same as 1 cup of walnuts, for instance, chopped. Do recipe writers pay attention to this when they write their recipes?
The good ones do. And it's also, by the way, like 1 cup sifted flour or 1 cup flour sifted.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All of these are different measurements, if you think about it. You know, it's logical. The reason you're asking the question is probably because you've come to that conclusion. If you've got little pieces of nuts, there's going to be more of them in a cup than a whole nut in a cup.
Right.
So when you see that 1 cup walnuts, chopped, that means measure out a cup of whole walnuts and then chop them. When it's 1 cup of flour, sift it, measure out the 1 cup of flour and then sift it. If it's 1 cup of sifted flour, sift the flour into the cup and then level it.
So we can be pretty sure that when recipes are written or edited that they're careful about this kind of punctuation.
Let's put it this
punctuation.
Way. If there is a recipe saint, yes. I mean, you're touching on something that annoys me a great deal and annoys a lot of other people, too, who write. There's not a lot of editing going on with cookbooks these mm-hmm. days. That's not true across the board. But, you know, there's a lot of recipes out there that have not been done very carefully. But if you start to learn kind of quickly when you look at the detail of reading a recipe, especially the description of what to do. If somebody has thought to say, take a 4-quart pot, cook this, over medium high for about 10 minutes or until it does this or looks like that. That's probably somebody who's really thought it through. And when they say 1 cup of walnuts chopped, They mean one cup of walnuts chopped. It's those super short recipes, you know, with five ingredients and they say, mix together, blah, 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 you know, and cook it. And it's like, well, wait a minute. If I cook it in a saucepan, it's going to come out one way. And if I cook it in a, you know, big wide pan, it's going to come out another way. And do I bake it? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the more specific the recipe, generally the more care someone's taken.
Okay.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Amy, for bringing something up that's really important.
Well, thank you very much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, she brought up a great issue. Especially now that we can go online and search for a recipe for just about anything and end up with hundreds of results, literally in seconds. Just remember to really take time to look over the whole recipe before you dive in. Because that way, if you see something that's unclear, you can divert disaster by moving on to another recipe. Now, I'm going to be taking more of your calls, as usual, later in the show. You can reach me, 800-537-5252, or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. You know, another area in which a little guidance comes in handy is planning summer parties. I mean, you have the big open sky, good friends, food cooking on an open fire. Well, humorist Charles Phoenix loves a good summer party, and he's taking his to a whole new level. LA Times writer Noelle Carter got a chance to hear his plans.
Charles, I'm so excited to meet with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. I'm so excited.
It's great. Charles, you were into retro Americana before it was considered cool. What drew you to our nostalgic, kitschy past?
Well, you know, I think I was born with it, really. The number one thing for me was cars. When I was a little kid, my dad was a used car dealer, so I was completely obsessed with old, you know, vintage cars. And the vintage cars then were the ones with big fins. I mean, they're still the vintage cars.
They have so much personality.
Oh, I know. So I got obsessed with that. And then I started, you know, with architecture and vintage clothing and then vintage photography, which led my interest in vintage food, even though I've always been a foodie all along.
Now, you're known for you're known for many things, but you're really known for your slideshows. Where do you get your slides?
The slides, I've been collecting other people's old Kodachrome slides now for 20 years. They just come to me now. I mean, for the last 10 years, they've just kind of arrived on my back porch. Rarely do I seek them out. They come to me.
That's so cool. You find a way to infuse this sense of Americana from these slides in everything that you do. And, you know, summer is such a big time for entertaining. It's more laid back. How would you approach a summer party?
Well, I mean, number one, around a pool. One thing that I want to do with the party this summer is I want to have, you know, the gearheads, give them something to do at the party. They're going to do a performance. I saw in a magazine from the late 50s once these floral pool floats. Like if you had a party, you'd put this in your pool. So you'd have to put it in there when the kids were done swimming. But you put the floral float in there, like, and it's something like a ladybug or a unicorn or whatever. Actually, I want two. And then I want underneath it for there to be remote control apparatuses where the gearheads in the family then have like
wild.
A remote control, like floral pool fight.
Fun for kids of all ages.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, you can't entertain without a spread.
Yeah.
What would you serve food-wise at
this party? Enchisagna is absolute.
Enchisagna.
It's enchiladas and lasagna finally get married at last. And it's a fusion dish of two American classics. And it is potluck perfection.
Now, how do you come up with these dishes?
Well, you know, I sit and dream them up all day. I love cooking and everything, but I always want to take it to the next place. I'm really into the evolution of our menu in general. I'm in shock over how in the last 10 years, like classic American comfort food has truly become the food.
Right.
It is our national cuisine. Hamburgers and hot dogs and macaroni and cheese. That's American food. I mean, you go to these like really snooty parties and stuff and they're serving sliders and French fries.
And you've got famous chefs exploring classic American dishes like fried chicken.
Well, they're all doing hamburger restaurants.
Right.
Well, fried chicken, of course. I mean, that's the thing about this stuff. It's so good. I mean, hamburgers are delicious.
Right.
So are hot dogs. So is fried chicken. There's no crime against it. And macaroni and cheese. I mean, you know, I love everyone doing their own macaroni and cheese. Macaroni and cheese is great. I'm also into cakes. You know, I invented the chirpumple. That's the three-layer.
I was going to ask you about that. Would you explain the chirpumple for someone who may not know about it?
The chirpumple is my pie-stuffed cake. It's the turducken of desserts. It's a three-layer round cake. Each layer has a pie baked into it. Cherry, pumpkin, and apple. Chirpumple. That's the name. The cherry goes into a white layer, the pumpkin goes into a yellow layer, and the apple goes into a spice layer. It's a cream cheese frosting. It is absolutely a crowd wower pleaser. It transcends class. That's the chirpumple.
It sounds like food and a showpiece.
It is. I mean, I'm into kitchen crafting as well. And, you know, my new recipe that I'm working on right now is called Bambrosia Nana. That's the fusion of banana pudding and ambrosia. Ambrosia is what I started with first, because I, in the slides I collected, the old Kodachrome slides from the 50s and 60s, I kept seeing pictures of people's dinners in the 50s and 60s, and I kept seeing ambrosia
on
the table.
Yeah.
And so, okay, you go online and there's a ton of ambrosia recipes.
Right.
Well, I brought it down to the bare essentials of ambrosia. The crowd-pleasing ambrosia is fruit cocktail that you have to drain, I mean, 24, if not 48 hours in the refrigerator before you mix in either Cool Whip, or if you're into the real stuff, you can do heavy whipping cream.
And draining, that would make the fruit a little chewier.
Drier, yeah. I mean, it's delicious that way. So, and then you, it's a fresh fruit cocktail, coconut, mini marshmallows, and Cool Whip or whipped cream. Is that all the ingredients? It's four ingredients.
Right, yeah.
It's the easiest thing in the world, but I tint it pink and people go nuts. So you got your pink ambrosia.
Food coloring is our friend.
Food coloring is our friend in fun foods, absolutely. Especially cakes and sweet things.
Excellent.
I mean, fun foods are often food colored. I mean, you can serve my 7-layer soda pop rock cake, which is a 7-layer cake made with 7-Up. It's a white cake, and then you put the bright food colorings, one for each.
And I love the Pop Rocks.
With the Pop
Rocks.
They
continue to fizz the entire time. It's fun.
Yeah, and it's fun. You know, it's about the presentation. It's about the coming together. It's about having the moment of service as well. I mean, every dish that you make should be presented with a moment. Like, look at this.
We eat food with our eyes first.
We do. And so I want it to look fun. I want it to look festive. I don't want it to look too perfect either. You know, I'm not about fine food. I'm about fun food.
Charles Phoenix, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Charles Phoenix is a performer, humorist, chef, and author. And Noelle Carter is food writer and test kitchen director at the Los Angeles Times, and she contributes to their food blog, Daily Dish. Now, you can find recipes for Charles's Astro Weenie Party Tree, his Enchizanya, enchiladas and lasagna married at last, as Charles would say, Bambrosia Nana, which is layered banana pudding and ambrosia, and 7-layer soda pop rocks cake. A food coloring tour de force. It's all on the website. Oh, and while you're there, be sure to check out the latest issue of our ebook, Eating In with Lynn. It's our version of the big summer party, a huge menu and lots of bonus material, and it's all at splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with grapes finally getting some respect and the new science of eating 5 a day. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Granny Smith, Pink Lady, Cortland, Macintosh, we see varieties of apples all the time. But when was the last time you saw a grape labeled anything but red or green, and occasionally maybe Concord or Red Emperor? Well, David Karp wants to change this situation, and he has the chops to do it. David is called the fruit detective by the food world. He studied everything about fruits for 2 decades. David writes a weekly column on produce for the Los Angeles Times. He is a champion of a recent grape variety that tastes like, of all things, cotton candy. Well, New York Times columnist Melissa Clark talked with David.
Hi, David. So great to talk to you today.
Great to talk to you, Melissa.
So why would anyone want to build a better table grape? What's wrong with the grapes that we already have?
Well, there's a lot that's right with them. They're sweet, they're kid-friendly, they're convenient, they're seedless, just pop in the mouth while you're driving down the road. But they don't have a lot of flavor. It's ironic because of all the agricultural products, wine is perhaps most highly reputed for being expensive and highly flavorful, whereas table grapes are neutral. Uh-huh. They're designed to appeal to the largest proportion of the public without offending anybody.
So they're basically sweet, but there's not a lot going on, is what you're saying.
There's not a lot of complexity. They're just sweet, neutral flavored.
Are there farmers who are working on creating a new breed of grape that combines
there
both
is.
The best?
It started with a program at the University of Arkansas 50 years ago that was inherited by John Clark, a good friend of mine. And John Clark started working with David Kane of a company that's now called International Fruit Genetics. And he's come up with amazing varieties that will just blow away people's conception of the potential for flavor in grape. Some of these varieties taste like pineapple, like strawberry. There's one called Scraggly because the bunches aren't very impressive.
Scraggly.
And that's the one that people always ask for because it has a rich, complex flavor, almost like a fine wine in a table grape.
Mm.
It will blow you away.
And are we going to be able to find those?
Not quite yet. But there is one really good one that's approaching commercial production for the first time this year. 100 acres of a grape called Cotton Candy,
ooh,
which really smells and tastes like cotton candy. It's interesting. It's thin-skinned. It's sweet. It's addictive.
Uh-huh. Is it a purple grape or a green grape or a red grape?
It's a green grape.
So a green grape that looks like a regular grape that has that wonderful texture, is easy to transport, but tastes like cotton candy. I think my kid will love that.
Yes, definitely. These other grapes are maybe a couple years down the road.
Uh-huh.
You see, you can come up with something that looks good and tastes good, but it doesn't have all the combination of characteristics that are desired by commercial producers and retailers, such as resistance to disease, productivity, uh-huh, easy to manage for a farmer, with appropriate post-harvest shelf life. It's not going anywhere. You can't reasonably expect somebody to plant something and then lose their shirts so that we can have delicious grapes. I used to think when I started out writing about fruit some 25 years ago that farmers should do that, but that's just totally unrealistic.
Are people going to be able to buy the grape cotton candy all over the country, or is it just a West Coast thing?
All over the country. It should be available this year from about August 10th to September 10th from 100 acres, which are coming into commercial production the first time this year. I begged Jim Beagle of the Grapery to tell me, well, which stores are they going to be available at? And he said, you know what? If we mention one store, then the others are going to be breathing down our necks saying, why didn't we mention us? So they will be available. Look for them at your stores. I certainly will
them,
myself.
Right? 100 acres doesn't sound like a lot, though. Is that a lot?
Well, it's not a drop in the bucket.
Right.
100 acres is getting there, and this is just the first step. I'm sure if it's successful, they'll be planting a lot more. And there will be other varieties, too, that are coming down the pike. I just can't wait for the strawberry one, and if they come up with something like Scraggly with that rich vinous flavor and a table grape, ooh-wee.
We're lucky. Okay, David, thank you so much for chatting with us.
You're very welcome, Melissa. Thank you.
David Karp writes a weekly column about produce for the Los Angeles Times, and Melissa Clark is co-author of Franny's Simple Seasonal Italian. Put some of those grapes to work with our recipe for supper tart of red onions, greens, and grapes. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. How about turning your front lawn into a masterpiece, an edible one? Well, the masterful part is thinking about how to turn a flat green space into something that invites us in, nourishes us, and perhaps changes our community. This is what artist and architect Fritz Haig calls an edible estate. It's one of the flock of projects that he creates around the planet. Fritz Haig has partnered with the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis for a year-long series of projects called Fritz Haig at Home in the City. Fritz, good to have you with us.
It's such a pleasure to be on the show. Thanks, Lynn.
Now, your edible estates, I mean, when I looked at the material about them, words to describe them have included confrontational, anti-capitalism, and you've described them as being between doom and hope. I mean, we're talking about the hallowed American front lawn here. I mean, what are you doing?
Well, it's a provocation, and it's a proposition in a way. It's a very public, prototypical garden that I work on with families in cities around the world to show other residents of that city how they might not just grow their own food, but reclaim this piece of land in front of their house that maybe they haven't considered. And at the same time, put food on the streets, put food growing in very dramatic ways that everyone gets to watch.
Could you paint a picture of one? For instance, I know you've done one here in Minnesota. Give us a picture of what this is.
The most recent garden is number 15 that's been planted in the suburbs of St. Paul in Woodbury with the Walker Arts Center. And this is, I have to say, one of my favorites so far. It's one of the biggest. It's on a 4,500 square foot front lawn.
Wow.
In a neighborhood where you wouldn't expect to see a garden like this. But all the gardens are as diverse as possible, planting everything I can get my hands on that will produce food in that region. And in the case of this garden in Woodbury, there's part of the garden dedicated exclusively to the child care center across the street. So there's a little kid's garden with triangular raised beds. There's a bread oven. There's
a bread oven?
Yes. And they like to let their neighbors know when they have it fired up so everyone can bring over their pizza and bread. There's a little fruit tree orchard. There's edible flowers. There's an herb garden. There's a big circle of stumps. That's the center seating circle. There's even hops growing up the side of the garage.
Huh. So this is not rows of corn, you know, growing on my front lawn. This is something obviously that's designed to engage.
There are no rows. There are no rows. So this is not a mini farm in that sense. It's a pleasure garden that happens to produce food. I guess, I don't know. I like gardens that are very rigorously designed and then allow wildness and chaos to happen. If a tomato wants to grow in the middle of the fruit trees, that's welcome. That's my approach to gardening, at least.
So what's the point?
The point is to make visible food production in the city, but in a very pleasurable way. And I think the whole point is for everyone to look at this and think, I could do this too. If nobody else does it in the neighborhood, let's say, at least everyone gets to watch and look at it. So those little kids growing up in that street that may not otherwise recognize that food grows on plants coming out of dirt, they get that reminder every day. And most directly for those kids across the street in the daycare center, they are gardening and growing food. So I'm thinking about everyone that lives in this city, in that neighborhood, in that street. But most specifically, I think kids are the easiest to reach with these kind of gardens.
How does the hope and the doom come into it? You said your gardens sit between hope and doom.
I'm an artist. I'm not a professional gardener or landscaper. And this is not an advocacy project. So I'm interested in storytelling and poetry and conflict, even conflict, if you can imagine that in a garden.
Oh, yes.
So when people look at these gardens, maybe there's a first initial just response of hope and this thought that, you know, we could all do this. And maybe at the same exact moment, you're having an opposite thought, which is no one's going to do this. No one has time.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of reasons where not everyone is not going to do this tomorrow. So I like both of those extreme thoughts happening simultaneously. And I do think when the garden is planted strategically in the right spot, those thoughts happen, both extreme thoughts, which I think are an honest reaction to the moment that we're in.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the spot, how do you select where the garden's going to go? Is this a case where people don't hire you to do this, right?
People don't hire me. So the people I end up doing these gardens for are people that already know how to garden and grow food, hopefully. But I do an enormous amount of work and research. So in the case of this most recent garden in Woodbury, the suburbs of St. Paul, I did an open call in the Twin Cities. I received 100 emails with pictures and stories.
Mm-hmm.
I visited 10 of them, and from those, I picked one. So I'm looking for the most provocative site, the site where nobody else is going to do this in the neighborhood. The family's really got a lot of hidden gardening energy that's mm-hmm. going somewhere else and putting it into a very public place in their front lawn in this case.
And they work with you on this. They have input.
Yeah, we work very closely. In this case, they have two grown kids that have just left the house. They have parents, grandparents that are very involved. They've got neighbors that are extremely involved. So there's an entire community that's using this garden and spending time there. But we plant it and then I leave and it's theirs. It's not my garden, it's their garden.
Fritz, incredible work. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lynn. It's been such a pleasure.
Architect and artist Fritz Haig's year-long association with Minneapolis's Walker Art Center includes installations, events, and projects. Now, for a sample of what can come from your edible estate and your grill, check out Eggplant Tomato Hobo Pack with Lemon and Garlic by Chris Schlesinger and John Willoughby, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. Want to talk superheroes? Well, forget the multiplex. 8,000 nutritional powerhouses lurk in the produce aisle. There are fruits and vegetables, and they're among the newest area in nutrition research. That's research on how phytonutrients work. So maybe you think eat lots of fruits and vegetables and great health will follow. Well, as science writer Joe Robinson learned in 10 years of reviewing 30,000 primary sources, our assumptions aren't necessarily so. Joe's written Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Nutrition. Joe, good to have you with us.
I'm really pleased to be here.
Now, you say something that's quite controversial in the book. You say the five a day, you know, that we're told we've got to have, you know, five servings of vegetables and X amount of servings of fruit for their nutrition is not doing the nutritional job.
No, it certainly isn't, especially the fruits and vegetables that most people choose. You know, the most common fruit is the banana, which is very low in different kinds of antioxidants, and the golden delicious apple, again, low in antioxidants, white potatoes. You know, iceberg lettuce is the most popular lettuce. These are the foods that people will pick if you say five a day, and most people don't even get that five. And so we're really alarmingly deficient in these wonderful antioxidant compounds that can be in fruits and vegetables.
Now, antioxidants do what?
They keep us alive.
Oh, that's basic. That's pretty, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're involved in every cell and system in your body, and they're defending us all the time against these noxious particles called free radicals that want to destroy cell membranes. They want to wreck our DNA and give us cancer. So we're bombarded with these free radicals. And so we need to fight them with antioxidants. And we truly wouldn't be alive without them.
Now, from what I understand, antioxidants are one of this relatively new area in nutrition research called phytonutrients.
Right.
Can you explain what phytonutrients are about and why they're so special?
Phytonutrients is basically a plant compound, and plants produce them, all plants produce them, to protect themselves against their enemies. I mean, they can't run and hide, so they make these chemicals that will ward off insects and browsers and protect them from UV light. And if we eat them, then we absorb those particles, those phytonutrients, and they protect us from our enemies, which happen to be cancer, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, diabetes, and obesity. So their protection becomes our protection.
But your premise in the book is that over thousands of years of agriculture, many of the phytonutrients have been bred out of the plants, right?
Exactly. You know, I got this information from over 6,000 studies, and the accumulating evidence is really alarming. Our, you know, like just the typical fruit or vegetable might have, from 1/2 to 1/100th of the phytonutrients of wild plants, which we lived on for most of our evolution. So unwittingly, starting 10,000 years ago, we started choosing plants to grow that were higher in sugar, higher in starch, and lower in these phytonutrients. And that trend, it continues today.
Okay, so if we've been breeding them out, if we decide to eat things like heirloom or organic, is that going to give us the phytonutrients, or at least some of the phytonutrients that have been bred out of
our food?
Yes, organic production. There's a number of studies show that they increase phytonutrients a small amount. Not every study shows this, but some do. Mm-hmm. And some heirlooms have many more phytonutrients than the ones in the grocery store, but not all of them. The Golden Delicious apple is a 100-year-old heirloom, and it is so low in phytonutrients and high in sugar that it can increase your triglycerides, these bad blood fats that are linked with the heart attack and stroke, and your LDL cholesterol. So not all heirlooms are nutritious for us.
So, all right. So then the big question is, what is out there that we should be eating? Because obviously this is not just a case of eat more apples. It's a case of eat more of the right apples.
Exactly. And one of the exciting things about my work is that I have found fruits and vegetables that are in every grocery store that are actually the equivalent of wild plants. They're not almost as nutritious as, they're actually as nutritious. And so you can just go to a grocery store, and if you were to buy green onions, they have like 100 times more phytonutrients than other onions in the store. I mean, they're inexpensive, they're common, and they're unheralded superfoods. And it's the green portions that are the best for you. So when you're chopping them up, you make sure you chop up all the green portions too. Kale, black, red, and dark red grapes, and artichokes, parsley, all of the herbs, they're just like eating wild plants. But just as important, in every kind of fruit and vegetable there's some that are much more nutritious than others. So let's talk about apples. The Golden Delicious is at the bottom of the ranking, and Granny Smith is at the top. But there are other, nutritious ones like Fuji's and the old Red Delicious, Braeburn's and Gala's. They're much more nutritious than Golden Delicious, L-Star, Empire, Pink Lady. So if you know which ones to choose, an apple a day can keep the doctor away.
Science writer Joe Robinson is author of Eating on the Wild Side: The Missing Link to Optimum Nutrition. Now, we're going to be back with more of that conversation with Joe Robinson. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're back with more from Joe Robinson, the science writer who has written about the new research into phytonutrients. Joe assimilated some 30,000 scientific papers and wrote Eating on the Wild Side: The Missing Link to Optimum Health. So, Joe, let's talk lettuces, salad.
Right. So the lettuce that we eat in the greatest quantity is the iceberg lettuce, and it is the least nutritious. And those inner leaves have so few phytonutrients because they don't have to protect themselves from the sun. They're all closed up, and so they're not making phytonutrients as protection. So when we eat them, we don't get it. What we want to find is lettuce that has an open structure so that all the leaves are fanned out and exposed to the UV light. Uh-huh. So they have to produce phytonutrients. So leafy lettuces are much better for us than the head lettuces. And in the leafy lettuces, the ones that are red-tinged or have the brown, green color or are all red are the best of all.
How about blueberries? Because this is a fruit now that, you know, everybody's talking about how nutritious it is for you.
It is. And we need to eat a lot more berries. On average, we eat 2 tablespoons of berries a week.
That's not very much.
It's trivial. And, you know, some of it's in those Pop-Tarts and stuff. Berries are excellent for us, including blueberries. But I recommend that you eat 1/2 cup a day. And there are some blueberries that are better for us than others. And if you go to a U-Pick farm, you can find these extra nutritious blueberries, or in the grocery store you can find frozen wild blueberries, and they're 2 or 3 times richer in these protective compounds than the fresh blueberries that we see.
Interesting. You also mentioned something about how you're supposed to defrost those berries, which I found intriguing.
Yes, and there's so many things that I read that I just had a hard time believing. So now that we know about these phytonutrients and that they're important for our health, the kitchen scientists are finding ways to preserve them in our food. And it turns out that if you thaw frozen berries in the refrigerator or on a counter, you lose about half of the phytonutrients.
Really?
But if you defrost in a microwave, you don't lose them. So it's a really fast thaw that protects the phytonutrients and gives us these great anthocyanins, which are good for our cognition and memory and fights cancer and cardiovascular disease. So there's these kitchen tricks that I write about that really can be instrumental in bringing back these lost nutrients.
Generally in cooking vegetables, better to cook them in the microwave or to steam them or to stir fry them?
You know, all of those are good choices. What you don't want to do is put them in boiling water, because the nutrients that dissolve in water, as that food cooks, the cells break down and those nutrients leak into the water. So if you were to boil spinach, for example, which most people do, you're going to have more phytonutrients in the water
right.
than in the vegetable. Yeah. So, and stir fry is good because it's not a liquid that the food is cooking in, so those water-soluble nutrients don't get into the oil. And if you use like an extra virgin olive oil, the food becomes more nutritious because mm-hmm. it absorbs some phytonutrients from that excellent olive oil.
I have to ask you about the garlic trick, because garlic, we yes. know, is very nutritious.
Right. This is an example of the kind of research that's in these dense academic journals that nobody's bringing out and telling consumers about. And that's what I see as my job. So here's the problem. If you take garlic and you chop it, dice it, and immediately fry it or put it in hot foods, it doesn't produce the nutritious compounds that are so protective. It's called allicin. And if you expose it to heat right away, it doesn't produce allicin, and we don't get that protection. We get the flavor, but we don't get protection against cancer, which is one of the primary reasons, health reasons, to eat garlic. So there's a trick. If you just chop and dice and slice or press that garlic, set it aside for 10 minutes before you expose it to heat, that garlic is producing all that allicin. And it's all, the reaction is complete. You can do whatever you want to it at that point. You can, you know, you can broil it or mm-hmm. you can fry it, and you get all of the allicin. So it's just press, rest for 10 minutes.
Who knew?
Yeah, some scientist somewhere figured this out.
So, Joe, do pesticides and fertilizers affect nutrients?
Surprisingly, they do. And what, like, let's look at pesticides. What they do is they protect plants from insects and other, you know, diseases and problems that
right.
would attack those fruits and vegetables, because we want them to be perfect looking. We don't want any blemishes. But that plant is so protected that it doesn't have to make any phytonutrients to protect itself. So it's lower in phytonutrients because we've coddled it. And we coddle all of our fruits and vegetables and unwittingly reduce their phytonutrient content and their health benefits for us.
Fascinating. Joe, thank you.
You're welcome. It's been fun.
Joe Robinson is author of Eating on the Wild Side, The Missing Link to Optimum Health. Now, one of the things I like about her book is she lists the individual types of produce with the most and the least nutrients. It's really handy in farmers markets, where often you actually can find the name of that blueberry or that cabbage.
Yeah. Look like you need some fixing in your kitchen. That's right, I said it looked like you need some fixing in your kitchen. I'm here to help you. Yes, indeed. Some fixing in your kitchen. I'm the one you're looking for.
It is time for us to talk. I'm game to take on almost any of your culinary questions, so give a call, 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, and you can always send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Caroline is on the phone from Athens, Georgia. Is it Carolyn or Caroline?
Caroline.
Ah, okay. I never am quite sure because people,
no one ever is.
I know. But what's on your mind?
Well, my husband and I have been married for about 3 years, and we're still on a pretty tight budget, but we love to eat. And we want to find some meals that we can cook that are pretty fast and also budget-friendly, but don't sacrifice taste or nutrition. So I was wondering if you had any ideas for me.
Well, what do you guys like?
We like pretty much anything. We're not picky. I love to shop at our farmer's market, but sometimes it gets expensive.
Yeah.
I like a lot of vegetarian dishes, but my husband likes to have meat every once in a while. So,
well, okay. How about this? First of all, you know, one of the great things to do is to look at cuisines where that's the way people eat every day. You know, where
right.
there's that little bit of meat and maybe there's a lot of grains, a lot of inexpensive vegetables, and a couple of places to look. Believe it or not, Africa is one of them. And there's some, you know, there's some African cookbooks that have come out over the past couple of years that are really interesting. There's one on Senegal, and I can't, Yolele, I think it is what it's called. And it's on Senegal cuisine, and it's a chef from Brooklyn. I mean, he's originally from Senegal. The food is fascinating, and the use of fruits and vegetables in main dishes is just amazing. The other thing is to think about using grains and legumes. And,
right.
And one of the great things to do, even when it's really hot out, is at night, boil up some barley or wheat mm-hmm. berries, and then take beans of any kind, dried beans. I can't get enough of chickpeas. And I mean, because I love their sweetness. And when you do chickpeas from scratch, and especially if they're a recent crop, you know, buy somewhere where there's really a lot of turnover. And with beans and grains, you can afford to buy organic, you know, because the price difference isn't huge, and you get so much from a pound of either one. But the
right.
idea is cook up the barley the way you might do pasta, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Take your beans, whichever beans you like. You might want to soak them in the fridge overnight. But when it's cool at night, cook those things up. And I always throw lots of flavoring into the beans, especially if I'm going to do something kind of unusual. I've gotten stuck on cinnamon sticks lately
mm-hmm.
with dried chilies. The fabulous.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you just throw it in the pot. And once those things are tender, the first thing you can do is you can freeze them, okay, in small packets. But
okay.
But now follow me on this. You chop up an onion. Whatever else is in season, if it's broccoli, if it's cabbage, whatever else you think you're really going to like, and you throw that into a wok or a skillet with some nice oil, and you toss that around until it starts to get brown. Now throw in some chopped up ginger and garlic.
Mm.
Toss that around. Then, and whatever vegetables you like, because what you're really making is like a vegetable stir fry.
Mm-hmm.
You could add a tad of soy sauce if you wanted to that. Or you could add almost anything. Barbecue sauce could even go into that combination, believe it or not. Orange juice, lemon juice. And then the thing is, you add a bit of the barley and you add a bit of the cooked beans. And you,
oh, wow.
You take them until they're hot. And you get this great, wonderful toss of all these great flavors. And by the way, when it's left over, with a little oil and vinegar on it, or fresh lemon, or fresh lime, it's fabulous at room temperature as a salad. Mix some fresh greens. Yeah, so you can keep, I mean, I've used leftovers from that. They have morphed into more things. It's hysterical. And then you'll have leftovers of your leftovers of your leftovers. But they change
yeah.
all the time. You know, I've taken that mix and I've tossed it with rice noodles and fresh coriander and mint and thrown a Vietnamese dipping sauce over it.
Wow.
It's hysterical. So that, but that's a basic idea, and it's not going to cost you a lot of money, and it's going to be really healthy.
That sounds great, Lynn.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was just so scared of eating just rice and beans all the time. So
No.
A lot.
Barley, wheat berries, buckwheat, lentils, and the bean world. Oh,
yes.
My goodness, you will not believe what you're going to discover in the world of beans. There's hundreds and hundreds, and they all taste different.
That sounds so cool.
Okay.
Let's look into the bulk section a little further.
And, you know, there's more beyond this, but this is a good place to begin. And thanks for, by the way, a great question, because a lot of people are in the same boat and are thinking along the same lines.
Yeah, we're just so busy that I work in a kitchen, and when I get home from work, I don't want to spend much time in the kitchen. So,
I understand. And this is a fast stir fry because it's already in the freezer and you just dump it in. What do you do in that kitchen, by the way?
I'm a pastry chef.
Oh, for
goodness
sakes.
I don't work with this savory, but.
Oh, this is going to be a piece of cake. I'm sorry, that was bad. This is going to be very easy. Yeah, very easy for you.
Well, thanks so much, Lynn. It was great to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. Melody in Manhattan Beach, California, wants to know the difference between cornmeal, polenta, masa, and grits, and can they be interchanged in recipes? Okay, here's the deal, Melody. Cornmeal is dried corn that's ground. Polenta is the same thing. And generally speaking, so are grits. But in some parts of the South, you'll come across hominy grits. And sometimes, not always, that word hominy means that the corn has been treated the way masa corn is treated. Here's what I mean. Masa and some hominy grits are where the corn is dried. It has a very, very tough skin. So it's soaked in lime water, not the fruit lime, but lime, the mineral. It's what you get when you burn wood. Those ashes used to be used, okay? That loosens the hull on the corn, releases it, and just gives you the pulp inside. Now, for Mexican tortillas, what you might do is just grind that moist corn. You get a dough, you season it, and you pat it into a patty, and you've got a tortilla. These days, often that moist ground corn is dried into what they call masa flour. The same thing is done with hominy. Now, what happens when you do that process is two things. You get that perfumey flavor that you get from a corn tortilla, and you also release all the niacin in the corn. And that was an important discovery that happened probably 3,000 years ago or so in the Americas, the Southern Americas, Mexico, Central and South America. Now, as far as interchanging them, you can't. You can interchange polenta and cornmeal and most grits, but not the masa part and not the hominy grit part. Okay? They're completely different animals. Hope that helps. Jim in North Carolina says, I'm confused by the term mince. Now, I use a pressed mince garlic. I can't use a pressed mince ginger, so I chop it very small. And lately, I saw a recipe calling for minced asparagus, so I just cut them in 1-inch lengths. Please clarify. Jim, I know it's confusing, but what mince means is to chop something as small as possible. So if you were going to mince that asparagus, you would mince it down to more or less the size of how you finely chop the ginger. It means to finely chop and bring things down to maybe a 16th or a 32nd of an inch pieces. And that's the basic idea. Problem solved. Okay, 800-537-5252. That's how you can reach us. Or you can shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. And of course, there's always Facebook and Twitter. Susan's on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Susan, what's up? What is on your mind?
Hi, Lynn. Thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I have been given some homemade Parmesan cheese, and I have about 7 pounds of it. And unfortunately, it's a little hard, so grating it is a little bit of a problem. What I've done is put it in a coffee grinder and
been able to make
some sprinkling cheese. But I'm wondering if you have other suggestions that I can use it for.
How old is this cheese?
It was made, I believe, last summer. My sister-in-law made up a large quantity of cheese.
Oh, this sounds fascinating.
It has a nice flavor to it.
Oh, this is great. Okay, this is what I wonder. You have to grind it in the coffee grinder, but you know, there's a great tradition of cheese salads. And what I'm thinking is, if the cheese is a bit salty, but it has that fullness and that lusciousness of the Parmigiano, it would be wonderful if you could grind it up or shave it and toss it with very lightly cooked, cut up sugar snap peas, a little bit of lemon and a little bit of olive oil and salt and pepper. It would be a wonderful salad. And it's the kind of thing that's done with that sort of cheese a lot. And then those peas can be swapped for the little new potatoes. You can go from there into the cabbage family. You can do mushrooms. But it's the idea that there's as much, almost as much cheese as there is the sugar snap peas. And then I cut them up into smaller pieces. The cheese goes over it in shavings or, you know, from your coffee grinder. And then you do the lemon.
That sounds fabulous.
Yeah, you do the lemon and oil to taste and some black pepper. And you can eat that as a main dish.
Great. Thank you. What a great idea.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it just occurred to me, that's fabulous with pasta. Really wonderful. Toss hot pasta with that, with a little bit of the pasta water. And you've got a light supper.
Ooh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
I'll certainly give that a try. Thank you very much.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You know, this is one of those things. When you have a cheese that really tastes good, think about, no, don't melt it, don't whatever. Make it into the main event. And, you know, good tasting oil, olive oil, a nut oil, any kind of oil, a good tasting oil and some fresh lemon and, you know, even peaches or melons, sweet and savory blends. Ah, wonderful thing for hot summer evenings. Just fabulous. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening in. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Ada Louise Huxtable, who said, "Summer is the time when one sheds one's tensions with one's clothes." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Go to splendidtable.org to get information on just about anything you heard here today. You can browse through our recipes, get registered for our podcasts and weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Take a look at our e-books, Eating In with Lynn. You get the idea. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.